Murray's Handbook for Devon and Cornwall, published in 1859, says of Polperro,
a fishing village in a situation eminently romantic, nestling on the rocky shore and ledges of a picturesque inlet.
This romantic description of the village, though geographically correct, pays scant regard to the inhabitants of bygone centuries, whose precarious existence was dictated by the ever-changing rhythm of the wind and the waves. Richard Carew, the Cornish antiquary, in his Survey of Cornwall, dated 1602, writes,
"The poor harbour and villages of Polperro croucheth between two steep hills, where plenty of fish is vented to the fish drivers, whom we call jouters."
From time immemorial, pilchards have moved in quantity to feed off the Cornish coast and were caught in abundance by local fishermen. In the 17th century, the British government, in order to finance a number of expensive wars with France and the United States, introduced high rates of duty on tea, wine and spirits, and other luxury goods coming in from mainland Europe. These levies made the clandestine import of such goods and the evasion of the duty a highly profitable venture for impoverished fishermen, and the seafarers of Polperro were quick to take advantage. Our visit to Polperro begins at the top of the village, at the historic Crumplehorn Inn and Mill. Owner, Sonia Crockford.
Part of it used to be a farm, the other half used to be a mill, and the two were combined, I think, in the late 1960s. And when we bought it 9 years ago, we asked the Cornwall Records Office to kind of look into the age of the building, and they traced it back as far as 1212, so it's pretty old.
And it was a working mill, was it?
It was a working mill. The outside step of the top bar door is half of the old mill wheel, and the other half of the wheel is over the fireplace inside the cottage, so parts of it are still there. So if you look at our slate 4, for example, every single corner of every slate is broken. And the story goes that they were kind of jimmied up with crowbars and things were hidden underneath. I've never tried it, so I'm not sure. But the story goes that there was a load of paperwork found in the loft of the mill.
In the early part of the 20th century, Frank Hill Pericost, a local historian, discovered a chest in the loft of the Crumplehorn Mill which contained the records of a man named Zephaniah Job. The records revealed that Job, who had died in January 1822, was a key figure in Polperro's clandestine trade in contraband, so much so that he has become known as the smuggler's banker. Originally from St Agnes on the north coast of Cornwall, Zephaniah Job had arrived in the village sometime in the 1770s. An educated man, he became tutor to the local children, and as the community learnt to trust the newcomer, he began to keep their accounts. Soon, he was acting as an agent for the smuggling syndicates, collecting monies and negotiating payments with the merchants on the Channel Island of Guernsey and the port of Roscoff on the French coast. Smuggling swiftly became the principal means of employment in the village, and by the late 18th century, Job was deeply involved in the contraband trade and handling the smugglers' bank accounts. John Wesley remarked, after visiting Polperro in 1762, that smuggling was endemic amongst the population.
"An accursed thing amongst them, well nigh one and all bought or sold uncustomed goods."
Job's income, bolstered by his other business interests, which included corn trader, seed and timber merchant, coal importer, land management, and the leases of a number of lime kilns in the area, grew and grew, to such an extent that in 1806 he obtained a banking licence and began to produce his own banknotes, amongst the first to be in circulation in Cornwall. I followed the stream that runs through the narrow village streets to the harbour and visited the Polperro Heritage Museum of Smuggling and Fishing. Recently, the museum has acquired some of Zephaniah Job's original banknotes. Tony White told me more.
His organisation of the smuggling trade was par excellence, you know. I mean, he got his bankers in Guernsey, he paid for the cargoes and saw the money got back to the right sources and bailed some of them out. And, I mean, he had his finger in privateers, he owned boats, he owned half the, quite a large selection of the village. He was into everything. He was quite a switched on guy. Well, we found out purely by accident that there was a big sale of provincial banknotes up in London, the Kirsch collection, gentleman who lived on Guernsey, I think it was. The whole collection was estimated to be upwards of £1 million worth. It was one of the biggest collections, I believe, that had been on the open market in a long, long time. And we were just very lucky. We found out that there were those two notes signed up to go and bid online, and sat there and we were lucky enough to get them both.
Because they are pretty rare, aren't they?
They are very rare. The only other ones we know of, the County Museum has a £5 note. We've got a £1 note, which is the used one, and the £5 note we've got is unissued. They were like a promissory note. So when the money was redeemed, they were signed off, which that one's got Job's signature on it. But we were exceedingly lucky to get them. Apparently, a lot of the provincial banks went out of business because they didn't have reserves to redeem the notes that they issued. And then if somebody wanted to try and put pressure on one of the banks, they chucked all the notes in for redemption. And of course, they hadn't got the money. When Job died, he had quite a lot of money stashed under the mattress. And he cleared off all his debts from all his banknotes without any problem at all.
The eminent Polperro physician and naturalist Dr. Jonathan Cooch attended to Zephaniah Job in his twilight years. Job died in 1822, aged 73. His contributions to the welfare of the village community, leaving behind a legacy that transcended the years. With changes in the excise tax and the strengthening of the law, smuggling died out in the 19th century, prosperity from mining across Cornwall ushering in a new era. The men of Polperro went back to their traditional livelihoods, and fishing once again provided the main income. But to this day, there are still tales from Polperro's smuggling days and the infamous ghost of a headless driver driving a hearse. In the 18th century, the smugglers of nearby Talland found it difficult to get their contraband away from the coast due to the valley's steep inclines. Slow-moving, heavily laden horses were easily stopped by the excisemen, and wagons were noisy. Then a smallpox epidemic broke out in the area. Battling Billy, the landlord of a local inn, hit on the idea of conveying his kegs in a hearse. No revenue officer would stop a hearse, especially with the threat of the dreaded pox, he thought. But one night, Battling Billy's plans went awry. A substantial cargo of brandy had been landed on the shore, too much for the hearse to contain. Billy managed to purloin a second hearse. Desperate to move the liquor before sunrise, it was quickly loaded. Suddenly, the preventive men came riding over the hill into Talland. "If they shoot me dead, my body'll drive the load to Polperro," swore Billy, grasping the reins and whipping his horses. He drove through the phalanx of excisemen like a man possessed, and they opened fire, the shots flying around him. The fishermen in Polperro awoke from their slumbers to hear the hearse thundering through the cobbled streets. As they watched in horror, Battling Billy, dead at the reins, his head hung over one shoulder, but his arms still lashing the maddened horses on, sped through the village, and without pause, the hearse, the horses, and Billy's corpse flew over the quay into the water of the harbour, never to be seen again. They say that even till today, on moonless nights when the wind is from Talland Bay, the ghost of Battling Billy's hearse is heard clattering through the streets. And until he is passed, the fishermen of Polperro keep their doors shut and their backs to the window, lest they should see him and court the death that he brings in his wake. Bill Cowan, originally from Plymouth, has spent the majority of his life in Polperro. Following his demob after World War II, Bill came to the village after a chance meeting with a skipper in Newlyn.
I come down here in 1948 when I was demobbed. But in the fishery officer's boat office, he had a crew wanted for a poacher boat in Newlyn. This was Sutton's. used to have the factory in Ale. They used to do paste, pilchards, and that. And a crew wanted for the pilcher boat. So I said to my uncle, I said, things ain't going along too well. I packed my bag. I said, I'll go down there. So I caught a train and I went down to Penzance. You had to get from Penzance and across the Newlyn. And I'm walking down the quay with my kit bag looking with all my gear in. And this voice shouts up, where the hell do you think you're going to go? So I looked down and this was a boat that came from this port. Because they always used to go down, you start your pilchard and down Newlyn, because your pilchards used to come around the boat first before they came up the English Channel. And it was Frank Oliver, he had a boat called the Patsyan. So I said, I got a berth down here with Sutton's. He said, Paul Pearl's a lot nearer Plymouth, you know what Newlyn is. He said, you won't get home very often here. I was single, of course. He said, you won't get home very often to see anybody home, he said. Better you come with us, he said. You get to Plymouth easy, he said, from Paul Pearl, but not from Newlyn.
Bill has fished the Cornish waters for more than 60 years and recalls a time when pilchards were plentiful and preserved in huge quantities in buildings called palaces. He showed me around one of these long disused fish cellars.
This is the same original doors here. That was the biggest pit. This was a medium pit and that was a small pit. And it was to do with the amount of pilchards you caught. If you had tons of pilchards coming in, you put them in the big pit. But if it was catches with slack, they wouldn't dirty the big pit, put them in the small one or the medium one. So put them in there, salt them in. That end store there was a salt cellar, rock salt. And it's a salt pilchard, layer of salt, salt pilchards. And after they've been there 6 weeks, they take them out. And this is, if you look here, you see a press bed here going along. And down that end there in the corner was a pit. The women used to work here. And they put down about a third, put the press on. And if you look at the barrels of pilchards, they're straight. They're not the beer barrels, they don't spill. And they press them down, a certain amount of oil would come up. And then they lay another layer, two thirds, press again. To the three layers, press again. And the oil used to come down, and that board had an incline running down to a pit down the end. And at the end of the day, they used to pick out the oil. It had any amount of uses. It stunk. It did really if you burnt it for like lamps and that. But it was used for grease. The artists used to love it for the paintbrushes, clean the paintbrushes out. They used to have one or two artists here, always come with a jar, because they have a jar of oil.
Artists, illustrators and writers have been drawn to Polperro since the advent of the railways made the Cornish coast more accessible. The author Sir Hugh Walpole lived in the village between 1913 and 1921, and his friends, who included Arnold Bennett, Henry James, Vita Sackville-West and Violet Keppel, were frequent visitors. A decade later, the talented artist Arthur Wagg lived and worked in Polperro and counted amongst his neighbours the celebrated author of books for girls, Angela Brazil. The Polperro arts scene remains vibrant to this day. Richard Knowles of the Polperro Arts Foundation.
We established ourselves about 12 years ago to promote artists in Polperro, and they had to have a local influence and live and work in the village. So we got together, formed a community gallery, Polperro Arts Foundation. That was back in 2001, and we've been going for 12 years. We are what you would call a community gallery. We give back to the community, and we have done every year since our existence. Artists that are currently involved range from photographers, printers, people with textile history, people like myself, I'm a retired architect, and we've got school teachers. It's a very broad, very diverse group of artists. We've tried to encourage people to come up into the gallery and to use the space for many events. We've had humanist weddings, we've had poetry evenings, we've had theatre, we've had acoustic jamming sessions. And out of these things have been born new poets, new artists, new groups of musicians, who are now quite well known amongst the community.
Artists and visitors alike often walk the southwest coastal path that runs through the village, a favourite route heading westward towards Talland Church. Here, the engraved slate headstones lining the churchyard tell of the hardships of the past and document the many lives claimed by the sea. Today, Polperro is a popular tourist destination, with many visitors returning time and time again. Sonia Crockford of the Crumplehorn Inn.
We have people who come back several times a year, year after year after year. They call themselves visitors, but they're not really. It's kind of like a big family. The visitors all know everybody by name and everyone says hello, and it's very relaxing and laid back and kind of has its own rules and own pace of life, which sometimes is a little bit opposite to everything else that's going on. And I think it's a break away from everything that's normal and stressful, and I think it gives your head a rest.
A visit to Polperro is a South East Cornwall Tourism Association production. It was written and narrated by Emlyn Glanmore-Harris and produced by Dead Interesting Productions. Little Church in the Wildwood by kind permission of the Polperro Fisherman's Choir.